chapter 18, and we're starting at verse 9. Luke 18, verse 9, and you'll find that on page 1056. I'm sorry we're such a squeeze this evening. Normally we meet in St. Helens, but because of the building works, we are squeezed in at St. Andrew's. And I'm glad you've been able to find your way here, and I'm sorry that it is slightly like a commuter train from Sevenoaks. But what a great problem to have, eh? And I'm sure we'll cope. Luke 18, verse 9. And he told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, "God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week, I give tithes of all that I get." But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, "God be merciful to me, a sinner." I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted.
Thank you, William. Do keep that passage open in front of you. And on the sheets that are on the tables, you can see a brainstorm question just to get you into the section of Luke's Gospel that we're in. Why don't you round your tables, or if you're sitting in the cinema seating, just with three or four people around you, have a look at this question. Skim read chapter 18, verse 1 to chapter 19, verse 10, the end of Zacchaeus. And then think to yourself, if you were to ask your friends or neighbours or colleagues, which of the people do they imagine would be blessed by God, blessed by Jesus? And which of the people do they imagine would get a rough deal? Okay, have a look through that and then we'll draw back together. You've got 5 minutes or so to do that. Think of the subversive nature of these chapters, the way they go against our expectations, or at least the expectations of people who aren't that familiar with these passages. It's been said, hasn't it, that the closest that most of us get to creative fiction is writing our CV. I don't know if you can relate to that, especially if you're a new graduate just arrived in London. One man who certainly could relate to it is a man by the name of Hugh Gallagher. A while ago, I read his application form for New York University. And you know, at the end of those kind of forms, it's got a box saying, "Please feel free to add anything else that you think might assist your application." Well, in that final box, here's what Hugh Gallagher wrote. He said, "I'm a dynamic figure, often seen scaling walls and crushing ice. I've been known to remodel train stations in my lunch break, thus making them more energy efficient. I woo women with my sensuous and godlike trombone playing. I'm an expert in bricklaying, a veteran in love, and an outlaw in Peru. I'm an abstract artist, a concrete analyst, and a ruthless bookie. Fashion critics worldwide swoon over my original line of corduroy evening wear. I can hurl tennis rackets at small moving objects with deadly accuracy, and thus have performed several covert operations for the CIA. Years ago, I discovered the meaning of life, but forgot to write it down. I've won bullfights in San Juan, cliff diving competitions in Sri Lanka, and spelling bees at the Kremlin. I've played Hamlet, performed open heart surgery, and I've spoken with Elvis. I am 18 years old next month. I wonder if you'd have given Hugh Gallagher a place at university or a job if he applied to your company or your firm. We can see why he did it, can't we? His application form stood out a mile amongst all the other thousands of forms that they received. And it's a tough world out there. It's dog eat dog. As the influential thinker Charles Handy put it, the motto of employers and universities today seems to be, don't count on us, count on yourself. We'll only help if we can. Now, that might be received wisdom for surviving life in the Big Apple or the Big Smoke. But what about life in the ever after? Is that the way that we get into God's good books, to rely on ourselves, to have a strong spiritual CV? Well, that was something that Jesus found himself talking about quite a lot. It's something he's talking about an awful lot in this section of Luke's Gospel. How do we get into the ever after? He was also an influential thinker. He's influenced millions down the centuries, but he's also offended many as well. And the surprising thing with Jesus is that he often offends those people that we might expect him most to get on with, you know, the religious types, the good guys. And the story that Jesus tells in this evening's parable, well, it's one of the most offensive to many people. At verse 9, look down to it, would you? We see the story's dedication. It's not to Aunt Agatha for all her help in the creative processes, but to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. What's Jesus on about? Well, being righteous is all about getting into God's good books. Having righteousness, it was about being good enough for God. So straight away we see that the stakes couldn't be any higher this evening. Understanding this parable will help you and me to understand who God accepts and why God accepts them. I take it there couldn't be anything more important for us to do this evening, anything more important for us to understand than the difference between being accepted by God and being rejected by God. So what was Jesus's received wisdom? Well, Jesus tells a story. It's a story, as you noticed, about two men who go up to the temple to pray, and then they go home again. No great shock so far. It was an everyday event. After the sacrifices were offered twice daily, there were two times of corporate prayer, at 9 a.m. and at 3 p.m. It would appear innocuous. It would appear insignificant. But please notice the sting in the tail in verse 14. Because Jesus' verdict is that it is the tax collector who goes home in God's good books rather than the Pharisee. Why? Well, Jesus says, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. Sounds like the kind of thing we might find in a Chinese fortune cookie, doesn't it? And yet as we've read through these chapters 18 and 19, I hope we saw that it wasn't just a corny cliche. But because as you've read through those incidents, you'll have met a range of people. Some of them, they exalt themselves before God, and they're humbled by Jesus as a result, and they're excluded from God's kingdom. And then we met other people who humbled themselves before God, the widow, the tax collector, the children, and they were exalted by Jesus as a result, and so included in God's kingdom. And right in the middle of this section, in verses 31 to 33 of chapter 18, do glance down to it, what do we find? We find Jesus describing, predicting his own death and resurrection in the very same language of verse 14. He describes his death as the ultimately humiliating experience. But then he'll be raised to new life in the ultimate exaltation. So as we come to the Pharisee and the tax collector, it may be very familiar territory for some of us. But we see who it is that God accepts and why God accepts them. The stakes really are that big. Jesus is presenting to you and me this evening the two extremes, the polar opposites of religious culture of the day. He takes on the one hand an epitome of religious goodness, the Pharisee, and on the other hand, the epitome of wickedness, the tax collector. And it's as if he holds them up for us to say, where are you? How do you think you'll be accepted by God? And on what basis? Now, there are two big shocks, and here's the first. God rejects the man who could do no wrong. Verse 10, two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee. Our trouble, I guess, is if we've ever heard that phrase before, we tend to have very negative images in our minds. The Pharisees are the kind of pantomime baddies, aren't they? If we've ever read the Bible, if we know anything of Christianity, we know that the Good Samaritan, well, he was a good guy, and the Pharisees, they're the bad guys. We know what we mean when we call someone Pharisaical, and it's not a compliment. We mean that they're smug and superior and condescending. A former colleague of mine here at St. Helens used to love teasing public school boys. And when I one day I asked him why he had such an enormous chip on his shoulder about it, he told me about a school field trip that he'd been on one day. They piled onto the bus. They left their school in the valleys in deepest, darkest Wales early. They filled their faces with their packed lunches before 11, and soon found themselves pulling up outside one of this country's most famous public schools. They fell off the bus in their rather tatty uniforms, looking slightly dishevelled, and landed onto the pavement in a kind of brawling mass. And just at that moment, two pupils from the school walked by, paused, looked down their awfully long noses, and said, "How unsanitary." Do you see, I suspect that's how many of us view the Pharisee. Smug and superior. We're already prejudiced against them, aren't we? But we mustn't. We mustn't jump to that conclusion, because back in Jesus' day, in the first century, we couldn't be further from the truth. The Pharisee was one of the good guys. He was very, very impressive. Let's think about him as a man. First of all, he'd have been a church man. He would have been regular as clockwork at church every Sunday, probably once midweek. He'd have come to the small groups. He would have been with his family for generations. He was a churchman. He was also a Bible man. If he was around today, he'd probably have had one of those impressive big black leather Bibles with passages highlighted or underlined that if it fell open in front of you on the bus, you'd have looked over his shoulder and thought, he must be a holy man. He was also a moral man. Verse 11, notice, he wasn't into extortion or theft. He wouldn't have made a good lawyer. He wasn't unjust or an adulterer. He wouldn't have made a good politician. Do you see, this is a man you could trust. You could trust him with your property. You could trust him with your wife. He was the kind of man, I guess, we'd love to have as a boss. We'd love to have as a neighbour. And then he was a religious man, verse 12, doing far more than the Jewish law required, into a kind of bonus points, a loyalty card religion. You see, far from being a bad guy, the Pharisee was a good guy, one of the very, very best. He was a man who could do no wrong. So what about us? Do we hear ourselves murmuring with approval as we have our view of this Pharisee corrected? Do we think to ourselves, he sounds a bit like me? Well, if we do, then we need to spot his two fatal flaws. Flaw number one, he regarded himself as righteous. At verse 11, he makes a big show of coming into the temple for that time of corporate prayer, a big show of coming into God's presence. But the person at the center of this Pharisee's world is himself. Now, unlike the prophet Isaiah, who cried, "Woe is me," when he came into God's presence, unlike the apostle Peter, who, when he encountered God in Christ, fell on his face, unlike the apostle John, who, when he encounters the risen, ascended Lord Jesus, falls flat on his face. Now, this Pharisee bowls into God's presence, walks tall, probably has his chest puffed out. Notice in verse 12 how many times he says I as he lists his goodness. He fasts twice a week when the Old Testament said he only needs to fast once a year. He gives a tithe, a tenth of all that he has, of all that he gets, rather than just his income. It sounds like real religious diligence, doesn't it? But do you see the danger? Instead of seeing himself as a debtor to God, it would be very easy for this man to assume that God must be in his debt. He was proud of his achievements. He was like little Jack Horner, sat in the corner, saying, "What a good boy am I." It's the danger of spiritual pride. Here's how Jonathan Edwards, the Puritan from America in the 18th century, here's him writing. Pride, he says, is the worst viper in the heart. It is the most secret, deceitful, and unsearchable in its ways of working, of any lusts whatsoever. It is ready to mix with everything, and nothing is so hateful to God, contrary to the spirit of the gospel, or of such dangerous consequence. Proud people can be such a pain, can't they? Samuel Butler wrote of two very self-centered people, Mr. and Mrs. Carlyle. Butler wrote, "How good of God to cause Carlyle and Mrs. Carlyle to marry one another, and so only make two people miserable instead of four." But of course, enumerating, listing our own goodness in that way is a classic way to avoid guilt within, isn't it? We become like the man visiting his GP, quick to tell him how his eyes and ears have never been better, quick to tell him how his hands and feet have never been in better health, all the while blind to the crippling tumour building behind his brain. Regarding ourselves as righteous, it's a fatal flaw, and it often leads to the second fatal flaw, regarding others with contempt. Verse 11, notice, the Pharisee stands by himself. He doesn't want to mix with a riffraff at Summerlink. He doesn't want to spoil his pristine ceremonial purity with lesser mortals. Notice how quick he is to say what he doesn't do. Verse 11, he's not ungodly or immoral. This is a man who's into negative obedience. We've already seen he's into legalistic obedience, and it's no surprise that he's into comparative obedience. Verse 11, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men. He's like the driver pulled over for speeding, who berates the policeman saying, well, at least I'm not a burglar. He's like the banker who fiddles his taxes while bemoaning the benefit cheats, or the MP who goes on and on about the rioters in our streets of London, while more than happy to trash a few streets when he was a member of the Bullingdon Club. Negative obedience, legalistic obedience, and comparative obedience. But of course, the issue isn't whether or not I'm like you at all, is it? The issue isn't whether or not you're like the person or any better than the person that you're sitting next to this evening. The issue is, what are we like before God? Do you see how the Pharisee uses all of these things to mask his own condition before God? He might feel good about himself, but please notice verse 14. His feelings are no guide to the condition of his soul. Well, what about us? Can we recognize ourselves in any way in this Pharisee and in his prayer? Verse 14 means we've got to ask the question, doesn't it? Because it's the tax collector, not the Pharisee, the model citizen who goes home right with God in God's good books. That ought to be the most shocking thing we've ever heard if we're new to Christian things. And I take it it's a shock because deep down, actually, we think good people go to heaven, don't we? But Jesus says it ain't necessarily so. Why? Well, because the Pharisee, verse 9, trusts in himself and his own righteousness. He is a model of someone, verse 14, who exalts himself before God. So here is the wake-up call. Here is the wake-up call to us if we're good or moral or religious this evening. Jesus is saying it could be those very things that act to keep us out of God's kingdom. Jesus is saying that it could be our morality or our respectability or our religiosity that acts to keep us, to exclude us from God's presence. They are not the way to God. This Pharisee stands as a stark warning to us. God rejects the man who could do no wrong, or thought he could do no wrong. Well, I think it's time we try to apply some of that. So why don't you, round your tables, or again in threes and fours where you're sitting, have a look at those discussion questions. How are we like the Pharisees today? Then you'll want to have a look at Romans 3, and then a discussion about pride. Over to you. Together then, shall we? And let me recommend three books to you that you might want to dip into to help your thinking with this all the more before life gets too busy for you. Two of them I read over the summer. Both of them, I think, are very important. Neither of them are very comfortable to read. Jerry Bridges' book, Respectable Sins, is brilliant, I think, like a laser putting his finger on the besetting sins of our constituency. Of people who would treasure the Bible, long to see people won for Christ, make a stand on ethical and moral issues of our day. Respectable Sins, read it if you dare. And then this helpful book by Tom Hoverstall, Extreme Righteousness, Seeing Ourselves in the Pharisees, has been one of the more uncomfortable books that I've read for a time, just in showing how the Pharisees are alive and well in the 21st century, and we are the Pharisees. So again, very helpful towards the end as to how to find a way out of that. So I commend that to you. And then C.J. Mahaney's little book, Humility, which is a very good read and very helpful indeed. Let me commend that to you. The second big shock. We've seen the first one. God rejects the man who could do no wrong. Here's the second shock. God accepts the man who could do no right. Verse 13, look down, would you? Enter the tax collector, stage right. The tax collector would have been one of the most hated people in the first century. Apologies if you work for Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. You may think not a lot's changed over the centuries. But back then, the Romans had set up a franchise system for collecting taxes throughout their empire. And so, because they didn't have the apprentice, if you're an annoying little irk and a thrusting entrepreneur and wanted to kind of get ahead, what you did was apply for one of these franchises. They were notoriously greedy and corrupt. They were crooks. They were collaborators with the occupying enemy. Think of those World War II movies with the provincial French mayor lining his pockets by grassing up the members of the resistance. And you get something of the picture. Tax collectors were disgusting, revolting people, the kind of people Jewish people would have loved to spit on. It was a brave thing for a tax collector to enter the temple courts at any other time other than corporate prayer, because he could have been set upon. They were the lowest of the low. And that makes the comparison with this Pharisee all the more shocking, because surely this tax collector can't be accepted. But please notice, will you, that Jesus says he can. He can be accepted because he gets two things spot on. At first, no one sees his unworthiness more than the tax collector. He is ready to admit his mistakes. At verse 13, he can't even lift his eyes to God, did you notice? But with his head bowed, he beats his breast. What does he say? God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Literally, the sinner. You see, he can't be more different to the Pharisee. Here's someone who knows he's got nothing to bring to God. He knows he's broken God's law. He knows that he can't keep it. He sees the truth about himself. He knows that he is the sinner, the worst rebel against God. But he also knows something else. He knows the truth about God. He knows that God is merciful. He doesn't give us what we deserve. And so secondly, notice that the tax collector is ready to ask God for mercy. The tax collector isn't promising to turn over a new leaf, to pull up his socks, to try harder. No, he cries to God to have mercy on him. And strikingly, he doesn't use the common phrase for have mercy. eleison. If you've ever sung in choirs, Kyrie eleison, Christ have mercy, Lord have mercy. He doesn't say, he doesn't use that common phrase. He uses a specific term, a term that speaks of sacrifice, a term that speaks of atonement. He uses the phrase helastomai. And so as the smoke is still lingering in the air from the sacrificial lamb, this tax collector beating his breast cries out to God, God, let it be for me. Make an atonement for me, the sinner. And so although Jesus isn't mentioned in this parable, he is right at the heart of it. Because this man goes home justified because Jesus has been presented as the sacrifice of atonement. As Paul goes on to say in that Romans 3 passage, Jesus dies that brutal, humbling death that we should have died. Do you see, the tax collector could do no right, but Jesus dies to take the punishment for people who are willing to admit that. It's as if Jesus swaps his perfect CV for our very imperfect CV. The tax collector pleads for God's mercy, and the miracle is he finds it. His name is written into God's good books, not because he earned it, but because Jesus gave it to him as a gift. How does the old hymn put it? Not the labors of my hands can fulfill thy law's commands. Could my zeal no respite know, could my tears forever flow, all for sin could not atone. Thou must save, and thou alone, nothing in my hand I bring, simply to thy cross I cling. I wonder if you've thought about that much over the summer. It's easy, isn't it? Over the summer we get out of routines, things that we know are ultimate and we know are important just slip off the radar. They slip into second place after transfer deadline day or getting that tan or getting into the new house or whatever it is. It is possible, because and only because of the death of Jesus, for anyone to be put right with God, to have their name in God's good books. God accepts the man who could do no right. It's a glorious truth. There are some more discussion questions for you to have a look at. I'm conscious we've got about 15 minutes, I think. So why don't you have a look at those discussion questions, but give a good amount of time to pray afterwards, to pray in this parable for ourselves. Let's turn to discussion.